Okay, I'd like to talk a little about the purely financial side of the crisis, link it up to the broader issues. And clearly we are in the middle of a huge crisis. It has lots of dimensions, but we can see, obviously, in daily newspapers that the stock market collapse is massive. Between 30 to 70%, this was done a week ago, I don't know what it is now. It affects many people. If you're lucky enough to have a pension, for instance, in the US, the average pension, based on the proportions of equity in of different kinds in pension funds, you'd have lost 20% since January. Commodity prices have collapsed, growth and profits are slowing, and unemployment is rising. So what I want to look at is the role of finance in this, and seems to me that global financial capital has been promoted by the deregulation of markets, the free capital flow, and the creation and promotion of credit, often in the form of new financial instruments, increasingly divorced from any real base. The issue of regulation is an important one, and you can see from these two quotes from Greenspan how things have changed so quickly. In 2005, private regulation generally has proved far better at constraining excessive risk-taking than has government regulation. And in 2008, he's saying, yeah, I found a flaw. I sure as hell did. And the next, the obvious question is, how could a seemingly modest increase in mortgage delinquencies cause a $57 trillion financial system to creak, and if not worse? And that's just the US side of it, and global capitalism as a whole to be threatened. But to some degree, the answer lies in, and I'm talking now purely about the financial, it lies in radical changes in the home mortgage market. Initially, the market was very straightforward. It was handled locally. You put your money in the bank, you borrowed it for mortgages, and there was a side guarantee in the States from the state, actually, at one point. Since 1970, mortgages have become securitized. Similar mortgages have been pooled together, and securities have been sold on the basis of those mortgages. So the initial model was straightforward. You put the money, the bank loaned to the mortgage holder, they bought the house, principal and interest were paid back to the bank. Very straightforward. Well, it should be a sidebar here. And many of these were actually guaranteed, as some are in Canada. Now, this is a new system. Here we have the borrower and the lender still. Borrower, lender, we now have brokers, and we have a servicer. We have here, this is the key actually, this is a black box, the issuer. And then you have investors. And what's happening is these mortgages are being put into different institutions and manipulated in many different ways, and then sold off to investors in return for cash. The borrower still services the mortgages, and ultimately, of course, pays for the investor. So you haven't changed that. Then you have all these other different agencies, a credit rating agency, which comes into the picture here, saying how good these particular securities are. Credit enhancement provider, we won't go into that. And then we have underwriters who guarantee these things. And finally, if they go wrong, you've got a trustee in bankruptcy, who's becoming very active these days. So the whole thing has become very complicated, and it's that issuer box that really is the key. As a result, the market in mortgages has really ended up on Wall Street, in banks and security firms, which repackage these things and issue them as credit derivatives or as CDOs, as they call them. So the market itself was divided into segments, high risk, medium risk, low risk. And these instruments were packaged in that form and charged accordingly in terms of risk and return. The securities were purchased at the bottom square in our previous diagram by institutional investors, wealthy individuals, and depository institutions themselves, including, of course, banks which are issuing them. So the whole thing becomes very complicated. This led to huge profits for those creating these instruments. And initially, the institutions that were placing them were these Fannie Mae and Freddie Mae, which had been state institutions in the state and were then privatized. More recently, and you recognize these names for other reasons, it's Wells Fargo, Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, who've been issuing these securities based on mortgages. And financed by organizations like the Washington Mutual. More about that in a minute. So that private securitization actually encouraged the underlying mortgage base and stimulated banks and other givers of mortgages to issue reckless kinds of credit. We've heard already from Bob that the asset base is you lose track with the asset base. In this case, it's houses. House prices were going up. They hadn't fallen in 30 years in the States. So what justified all this manipulation was that they would rise. And therefore, so if people come in and they don't have sufficient credit, who cares? The house price goes up. This became built into the system, of course, in more ways than one. The securities were issued based on this expectation that house prices would go up. But of course, as house prices went up, it became very important as a stimulant of demand. In 2005, 10% of GDP was generated by people withdrawing equity from their houses and spending it. So the whole thing is kind of circular. What they call subprime mortgages and slightly better ones called Alt-A mortgages. They just ballooned in frequency. And in 2006, which was the height of this, they dominated the mortgages being issued. Okay, so these mortgages were pooled into what is called collateralized debt obligations, and somebody else ended up holding them. And these instruments will be passed on from organization to organization, and new instruments will be created by pooling them together. So the result was that the different classes of risk was simply, people, if you read the literature, there's three classes of risk. There's great risk, there's mezzanine, and then there's equity or useless risk. In fact, 80% of these instruments were classified as the best, regardless of the content of the quality of the instrument. And so you see here just how this expanded in 2000. It grew every year, and 2006 was the height. This here are these CDOs. This here is kind of credit card debt and motor vehicle debt, and then here you have the mortgage-backed securities. So it's these two that we're talking about, which are related to the mortgage industry. If we could move on. These instruments are incredibly complex. They were issuing $3.7 trillion in 2007. The quality was falling. Many of the underlying mortgages were so-called ninja mortgages. They had nothing to back them up at all in terms of income or assets. And they were given teaser rates. People were sucked into getting these mortgages by very low interest rates for a number of years. And of course, later on, the rates would jump up, and people couldn't afford them. And that's what happened in 2007. And the hedge funds were extremely active in these. And hedge funds, of course, borrow money and then buy into these securities in a big way. And the underlying value was totally unknown. In 2006, it all began to unwind when interest rates started to rise. People found they couldn't afford these houses. And delinquencies started. Once you start with a delinquency, it simply catches on very quickly. The hedge funds suddenly find that the value of their assets, which are not marketed, but they have to write them down when the underlying mortgages decline. In order to compensate for that, they have to put in their own capital. They do that by selling off other assets. And of course, as they sold off the assets, all kinds of things started to come unraveled. Some of the issuers of these securities were actually banks, but using off-balance sheet institutions. But they guaranteed these institutions. Once the mortgages started to unravel, they had to put it good on those guarantees, bring them into their own balance sheets, and now, of course, they're making billions of dollars of losses, which everybody can see. And it went beyond banks, of course, to investment houses, hedge funds, and credit insurance schemes. These assets had been held widely internationally, and that's why you get the ricochet right across the globe. And this leads, of course, as institutions start to pull back in, liquidity becomes a problem. The only way they can shore up their finances is by pulling in their assets, but that's somebody else's liquidity. So the whole liquidity system starts to shrink, and credit crises then take over in a different way. If you look at the extent of the current crisis, and this is completely out of date now because it was published earlier this year, these are banking losses. The dark green are banking losses, and this is other financials. And this is the amount that we're talking about here, 1.4 trillion, much bigger than the Asia banking crisis, the Japan banking crisis, or the US savings and loan. We're up to about 10% of GDP just on this scale. Okay, so what about dealing with the crisis? The crisis is global, it's affecting most countries, but in varying degrees. The solutions that have come forward so far are state intervention, which has been widespread. It's taken the form of bailing out the banks through equity purchases. In other words, nationalization. The giving of deposit guarantees, these have gone up quite significantly in most places. Emergency credit, lowering interest rates, and expanding liquidity. I think rather than going into, what I was going to do was go into details of how they've done this in the States. Well, maybe I'll just go to that quickly. And the $700 billion bailout came after the WaMu, the Washington Mutual, went into receivership after customers withdrew $16.7 billion. Once depositors know that the underlying asset base is weak, they pull their money out. It happened in England, it happened in Holland, it happened in the States. $700 billion, George Bush, when he was asked about what he thought about the $700 billion, he said, if we don't get this money, this sucker's going down. based on what's happening elsewhere, the $700 billion is not going to be enough, chances are. But that's a range of things that has happened in the States. They renationalized Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Insurance limits have increased, and so on. If you could move on, keep moving on until you reach Canada. I'll very quickly just look at what the whole of Europe is in the same boat. we can deal with it very quickly. I should add, though, before we talk about Canada, there's a whole bunch of countries that have been affected by this. And they're countries which are highly deregulated, very open capital markets, have been relying heavily on international private flows of international capital, not so much government. They've been taking the advice of the deregulators to do that. And so we now have the Baltic states, the Ukraine, which has just taken a $16.5 billion loan from the IMF. We have Argentina. There's a whole bunch of countries which are simply in deep, deep trouble, and I think that's just the beginning. Canada, of course, we're claiming that we're okay, we don't have a problem. Last year, there was a Montreal Accord, which was privately regulated, but $30-odd billion to keep large institutions afloat. Many of the pension funds that had these asset-backed securities in Quebec and elsewhere, even some credit unions, not here, but elsewhere. The Canadian banks have written down almost $12 billion in the last year. And the government introduced recently a $25 billion liquidity provision through the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation. No problems in Canada, right? So the claims that the banks are not affected are looking a bit shaky. Last week, a new... I beg your pardon. The Bank of Canada introduced purchase and resale agreements providing liquidity an extra $30 billion. They've lowered interest rates, and we're now changing accounting standards so that we don't record the losses. We kind of put them off a little. We did that in the 1980s with the debt crisis. And last week, a new facility was introduced by the government which would provide up to $218 billion worth of support for the banks. And the provinces are urged to do the same for the credit unions, which is an interesting development. So what does it all mean? Well, it means, first of all, that neoliberal approaches to economic management have been discredited, clearly. There's been a massive socialization of private debt. That's the way we always do it in every crisis. We pick up the pieces. There is mass nationalization of financial institutions. In my youth, I was nationalizing banks. This is not what is happening now. What is happening now is bailing out the private sector, and later on they'll sell them back to the private sector, and money will be made in the process. So I think this is going to be temporary, unless the whole thing really collapses. Interstate cooperation is much higher than it's been for a long time, and that may prevail, and maybe new institutions are coming out of this. The $700 billion bailout has been called socialism for the rich by Manchester and the Guardian. What is disturbing to me is that there's no ready left alternative or even a social political mobilization. Here we are, the damn thing is collapsing, what do? Return a minority conservative government. I think that's quite disturbing. And we can't underestimate the capacity of the system to adjust to falling rates of profit. And of course, the less opposition there is to this, the more readily will it be able to adjust. Thank you.